Cloud chamber example. Why it is that when you have an S wave in a cloud chamber decaying, that in every individual instance when it happens, you see a straight line going out, and you don't see some muy S wave uniform thing. Okay, this is, as I mentioned, very closely related to the question, the last one of these interpretational questions that bug people a lot. It's very related to the question why it is when you actually do an experiment, even though the outcome is probabilistic, blah, 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 when you do the experiment, you get an answer, one answer, right? You do it, you get this answer. Even though the whole wave function in the universe, including you, your brain, the system, the apparatus, is some entangled thing, nonetheless, you don't feel entangled. You feel you got a particular answer. These two questions end up being very closely related to each other. I should say, I really should say again, there are some people who talk a lot about these interpretational questions in quantum mechanics, and to them, the explanations I'm giving you are somehow not satisfying. I don't know why. I don't understand why at all. And I mean, I've tried to understand, I just don't understand why. And there's many of us who don't understand why. So, just so you know, what I'm saying isn't like everyone. If everyone completely agreed about what I was talking about, there would be no field of the foundations of quantum mechanics. Okay, because, and I actually think there isn't such a field. There is. No, I really mean this. There really is. But the issues have to do with gravity and cosmology, not just quantum mechanics as an isolated thing. There's really very serious and deep problems that we'll talk about when the words gravity and cosmology are used in conjunction with quantum mechanics. But before that, I don't see any issue. And you'll probably hear lectures from some of these people, and maybe when they come, you should ask, what's wrong with this kind of argument? I've asked, I never understand the answer, but I'm a quantum philistine. Which is not to say that it isn't very strange, of course, as I said, I don't see any issues until you talk about gravity and cosmology. And actually, to be very specific, it's gravity and cosmology. There isn't even any issue with quantum mechanics when just the word gravity is used. Quantum gravity makes perfect sense without touching quantum mechanics. If you want to talk about the properties of quantum gravity in a flat space, or even better, if you want to talk about properties of quantum gravity in anti-de Sitter space, the problem in anti-de Sitter space is a solved problem. Quantum gravity in anti-de Sitter space is a solved problem. We understand how it works. It's a conceptually solved problem. We don't understand it in all details, but the big part of the problem is solved. It does not at all involve modifying quantum mechanics. In fact, it's shocking what a conservative solution it looks like. Okay? It looks like a good old-fashioned particle theory. Good old-fashioned quantum field theory in four dimensions ends up being equivalent to all of string theory and all of quantum gravity and all this stuff in 10 dimensions in an asymptotically anti-de Sitter space. A shocking fact. Even if there is no proof, it's still a conjecture, but it's passed 15,000 tests. Okay? And it passes these tests in such an incredibly non-trivial way that it's clearly it knows much, much more about quantum gravity than we do. Okay? So that does not involve modifying quantum mechanics. We very likely understanding the scattering of particles in a space that starts flat and goes out flat doesn't involve any modifications of quantum mechanics. The only time when the quantum becomes confusing is when the word gravity and the cosmology is used at the same time. Okay? This is the fifth time now. I will talk about it, but that's the final place where there seems to be some hint, some possibility of something strange going on. Okay. So it's not even just the gravity part. Yes.
So what about the Hawking paradox?
That's a solved problem. Okay. So no, I mean this is very, very important. This is a very important slogan. Progress happens in our subject, okay? And it does no use obfuscating it. It's very important to recognize when it happens because then you get to move on. Problems get solved, You know, it's a field full of incredibly talented people who work amazingly hard and they solve problems. So one might have some emotional attachment to thinking that quantum gravity is going to be some mind-blowing, incredible thing that'll take centuries to solve. Okay, there are people who had a very pragmatic attitude to it and solved it in Anti de Sitter's fix. Okay, this is an incredible thing. It's a solved problem. The way they solved it, by the way, was just following their nose, doing important calculations, asking sharp questions, turning vague words into equations, which is the hardest part of theoretical physics. Absolute hardest part is turning vague ideas, which you absolutely must have, into equations. You need the first part. You need some philosophy. You need some guiding principle. But turning it into something that works is the magic. Okay? But it happens. And you know, you shouldn't think that this is all up for grabs. Certain parts of the problem are solved. That's wonderful, because it means that actually the guts of the problem and the hard part of the problem and its important aspects are now completely clear, and we can start focusing on that. That was the sort of point of these whole sequence of lectures, is to get you to a point where you realize what we've solved and what we haven't. So where it is that we have to go. But anyway, I didn't want to go into this too much, but I really did want to say, I mean, I don't want to give any impression that there's anything wrong with quantum mechanics, even talking about quantum gravity. The only issue is something that's so confusing, no one even knows the right language to talk about it yet, which is applying quantum mechanics to cosmology. I should even say, had it not been for the fact that our universe is accelerating, had we had a universe which, like people thought in the early 90s, would expand forever, okay? In such a universe, even there in the context of cosmology, there is a sensible way of talking about quantum mechanics. There are sensible ways of talking about this idea of a wave function of the universe. Okay? So it's not even the mere presence of cosmology. It's a very specific sort of cosmology we find ourselves in that makes things so confusing. Okay? But that's so far down the line that it's really well worth taking quantum mechanics dead seriously. And as I said, we don't have anything better to replace it with either. So this philosophy of radical conservatism tells you to push until you just cannot possibly make sense of it anymore. And maybe someone will find some clever way of making sense of it, even in this context. Anyway, so let's go back down to Earth and talk about our particle in the cloud chamber. Okay, so we start off with the electron or something in an S wave, and the cloud chamber in its ground state. Okay, so cloud chamber with all of its particles just sitting there. Okay, now, what we'd like to do is see what happens after the decay, right? So let's first look at what the state looks like after the decay. Now, here comes the important point. What are the states? Remember, we said before, the states that decohere, the states that are, there are some states in the system that are going to evolve in an approximately factorized way, right? So what are those states? Those states are not the angular momentum eigenstates. Okay? Those states are like a momentum eigenstate of the electron moving that way. Forget about the fact that the initial state happened to be S equals zero. Let's just ask abstractly. If I took an electron moving that way, localized electron moving that way, then that would evolve in time into a quite factorized state. The electron would basically still be moving that way, and the cloud chamber would, you know, start lighting up a path in the direction the electron was going in, right? So in other words, forget this S equals zero state. If we gave a state with the electron moving that way and the cloud chamber in its ground state, this would quickly evolve to the electron still moving that way and the cloud chamber, you know, lighting up with little bubbles moving that way. Is that clear? So far, so good? Okay. Now, we don't have one of these states. We have this S equals zero state. But what is that S equals zero state? That S equals zero state is just a coherent superposition of the electrons moving with all possible p's. Right? So this initial state is really an integral over all angles, let me just call it schematically d omega, of the electron moving with some angle omega, okay? That's the initial state. The cloud chamber is like that, okay? And now because I know what each one of these guys does by linearity, it's just the same kind of argument we had before, I know what the new state is. The new state is the integral d omega, this guy moving with omega, and the cloud chamber in that direction. Okay? So far, so good? All right, yes. Really, I don't mean definite, but I mean a sort of localized electron moving in that direction.
Why does that evolve?
Because of the locality of interactions in space. Okay? It's the same reason why the classical-like states are localized in space. It's because the way the electron interacts with the cloud chamber is that positions in space. So as it moves along, it changes the state here. Then it changes the state there, it changes the state there, but it's not being disturbed very much itself. Okay? So it's because of locality of interactions in space that these things that are localized in space are nice states that evolve in this factorized form. That's the critical point. It's not just some totally abstract thing that positions are nice because classical physics says positions are nice. It has to do with the fact that interactions are local. Locality of interactions makes things that for which the locality of interactions is manifest in the evolution of the state, make them be the nice states that evolve in this factorized way. I forget what the language is. I think maybe these states are called pointer states. That when you have states in a system and a bath, the states that evolve of the system that evolve in this way that keeps the factorized form are called pointer states of the system. Okay. And so it's things that are localized with roughly localized position and momentum, which are the nice pointer states. Okay? Maybe I'm using the wrong terminology, so I apologize. I haven't followed what's going on in this subject for about 15 years. So. Okay, so. All right, so this is the state. But now we have to ask ourselves the question, why in any given time that it comes out, why does it look like it's a line? Right? This might still not leave you satisfied. Okay. Well, to ask any questions, the theory is quantum mechanics. To ask any questions, you have to ask the question in the language of quantum mechanics, right? So we want to know why it looks like this thing is always coming out like a line, right? So there's an observable. Is it a line? Is an observable, right? So to ask this question, we should then talk about the operator that would go along with that. So there should be some operator in the Hilbert space. Let's call it, is it a line operator? A linearity operator, L, okay? This is the operator. And what we'd like is to see whether, so we'd like to see whether this state is an eigenstate of is it a line operator, okay, with eigenvalue 1. If it is, then with certainty, it's a line. Regardless of what the state looks like, what our feelings are about it, we need to ask the question in the language of quantum mechanics, all right? Okay, so now, I don't have to construct this line operator as a function of all the variables in the problem and so on. I just need to tell you some properties that it obviously has. Clearly, this is a line operator. Whatever it is, should have the property that if it acts on a case where the electron is going in a line and the cloud chamber is lighted up in a line, okay, this should give me +1 on that state. Because certainly, if it is going in a line, and the cloud chamber is lined up in a line, then this is an eigenstate. It should be an eigenstate with eigenvalue 1. That certainly is a line. Right? There's all sorts of other states for which this should annihilate. For example, if the electron's moving in a line and the cloud chamber is doing crazy things, then the line operator on that state should give me 0. Okay? It is not a line. Okay? So this is some operator to do many things. It annihilates the vast majority of states in the Hilbert space, but these states should have eigenvalue 1. Is that uncontroversial? If that's uncontroversial, we're done. Because let's apply that line operator to this state. We get 1. Because every component of it is 1 under the line operator. So the is it a line operator acting on the state is indeed equal to plus the state itself. That's why we're certain, after one decay, that's why we're certain that it is a line. Now, you could have asked another question. You could have asked, is it a line in this direction? No way is it an eigenstate of that state, right? It is not an eigenstate of the, is it a line in that direction operator, okay? But is it a line at all operator? Yes, it's absolutely an eigenstate of is it a line operator with eigenvalue 1. Yes? Yes.
Is the equivalent thing that you say in response to that that you have to define some operator that says, is it going in this direction? Is that something you're saying?
Well, so just to give an example of something that would not work, if I ask, is it moving in this particular direction? Or even, let's say, is it moving, just to make it a little more, is it moving somewhere between here and there, in that angle, right? That's a nice operator I could talk about. I know how that operator acts. It acts on states moving, and then that angle gives me 1, otherwise it gives me 0. I can ask for that operator, I can ask, is this state an eigenstate of that operator? The answer is no, it is not. Okay? So I do not have any certainty about whether it's a line in this direction. But if I ask another question, if I ask the question, is it a line at all in any direction, then I do have certainty, and it is a line. With one experiment, with a single decay, right? Now, we could actually do something else. If you wanted to pursue this line of thinking more, normally we say that I can't predict the direction it comes out in, but I can predict the probability that it comes out between here and there, okay? So how could we pursue that analogy further? let's say we define an operator which checks whether it's within some little angle, okay? This state is not an eigenstate of that operator, no question. However, what you find, interestingly, is the following. If you now do the experiment over and over and over again, if you repeat the experiment over and over again, you now start getting a much, much bigger state, right? The state is now, it just happens many, 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 many times. You roughly get n, if you do the experiment n times, you get n tensor copies of this state. And what you now find is that n tensor copy, as n goes to infinity, does become an eigenstate of the is it a line in this direction operator. And its eigenvalue becomes the probability that it's moving in that direction. So this is related to the, so this is a set of equations that goes with the many worlds story of quantum mechanics, but it has nothing to do with this picture of universes branching off and all that stuff. It's really a very sharp and concrete statement that if you take alpha up plus beta down for a spin a half, if you take that to the n, you take n copies of that. You imagine doing the experiment n times. Then that state, for a finite n, that state is not an eigenstate of the number of up spins or the number of down spins. Okay? It just isn't. But as n goes to infinity, it becomes an eigenstate of the number of up over n and number of down over n operator. And the eigenvalues become alpha mod squared and beta mod squared. So that's why I was telling you that even the probability postulate of quantum mechanics can be derived from the first one. Okay? And it tells you that what you have to do is do the experiment infinitely many times. The, when you do the experiment infinitely many times, the big state that you get, that big state becomes an eigenstate of something you would call the probability operator. And its eigenvalues are what we call the probabilities. But, we could talk about that. So maybe that's something that can be done. That's actually, just take that little example, alpha up plus beta down to the n. This is a very, very nice exercise. It's a very simple exercise in binomial expansions and Stirling approximations and things like that. But if you take alpha up plus beta down, and you take sort of n copies of this, and so let's say you call this state psi n. And now let's say you look at the number of up over n. Let's call this the p up. And similarly for down, you call it p down. So let's call those let's call them the probability operators. They're operators, right? They count the number of up spins, and you just divide by n. Then what you find is that the limit as n goes to infinity of p up psi n becomes alpha mod squared psi n, limit as n goes to infinity. Similarly, down becomes beta mod squared. So this is how the standard rules of this is telling you that while one experiment doesn't have a definite outcome, doing the experiment infinitely often is the eigenstate of some operator. It's the eigenstate of the probability operator, and this eigenvalue is alpha mod squared. Okay? So it's not a separate postulate. Now, you need to epsilon delta this a little bit because there are limits as n goes to infinity. So really what you say is that when we go back and we say that a state, when it's an eigenstate, when it's an eigenstate, then you have definite value for the corresponding eigenvalue. Otherwise, who knows what it is? That's a little bit harsh, right? Because what if it's almost an eigenstate? What if it's within 0.999999b of being an eigenstate? Then it seems a little hard-hearted to say that you know nothing about that state in that case. So what you really do is you go back to the first postulate of quantum mechanics and you add a little bit of an epsilon delta to it. You introduce a notion of a confidence. You say, and this is really what experimentalists do, okay? You say within some confidence, 1 minus epsilon, you have this value if the state is within epsilon of being an eigenstate. And you can define what you mean by within epsilon of being an eigenstate in some standard way. Okay? You just see whether it's possible for the overlap between your state and the actual eigenstate gets bigger than 0.999. Say you declare that. Okay? Then if you do that, you find that there is, for some fixed confidence, there is some n for which you have a definite value of the probability operator within that confidence. Then as you send n to infinity, the confidence gets higher and higher, and eventually this state with an infinite number of spins, with the experiment is done infinitely many times, actually becomes an eigenstate of the probability operator with the corresponding probabilities. Okay? So even this probability interpretation is actually isn't a separate thing. It's just the consequence of, and it's even telling you, you've got to do the experiment infinitely many times. And actually telling you a little more sharply. It's telling you that if you want to have confidence n, that it goes like 1 over square root of n. Okay, this is a standard statistical notion of the statistical uncertainties having to do with having done the experiment a finite number of times. Okay? So ultimately, this is what experimentalists do. They have statistical errors and systematic errors. The systematic errors is because they're not as good experimentalists as they should be. The statistical errors are ultimately, deep, deep down, quantum mechanics. Okay? And there's just some statistical thing that you cannot reduce because you haven't done the experiment often enough. Okay? You really get a feeling for how uncertain the world of quantum mechanics is, especially in particle physics, because we do these experiments in colliders all the time, and every now and then weird things happen. And you say, wow, that looks like the standard model is breaking down because this process happened. Well, but really things just fluctuate. The world is quantum mechanical. Strange things happen, especially if you do many, many different kinds of experiments. The probability that something just statistically fluctuates is not low for one of the many experiments you did. And so you really have to start asking somewhat uncomfortable questions about how confident you are that you're seeing something or not. And when the sort of statistical uncertainties are on the sort of part in a thousand level, then given that we've done sort of thousands of different sorts of experiments, if you start seeing something anomalous, you really have to start wondering if it's really anomalous or it's just because you quantum mechanically fluctuated and you didn't know, but otherwise that there's nothing funny going on. And it really, this dice playing nature of the way the world works really hits you in the face in a very dramatic way. You hope to reduce these sorts of things by increasing n dramatically relative to the number of kinds of experiments you're doing, so that when you start seeing something, your confidence increases in what has happened. But it's always a statement of confidence. Okay? There's this thing that we say, don't worry about the fact that quantum mechanics, you can't make predictions, it's all, we can still predict the probabilities, it's all great, and so on. It's kind of a fiction. We always have to live with an irreducible source of uncertainty. And all we can ever talk about is confidence. And it's just life, and you'll see it on every experimental plot. If the experiments are really good, the systematic errors are small, and then all you have sitting in front of you are the statistical ones.
So basically,
yes.
It's untrue to say that the object A has probability B. Right?
That's right. Because we can, yes, that's right. It's a statement with confidence is attached to it. And if you can do the experiment, so this is what I was saying. There is a limit in which it makes sense. And this is why when we do experiments, we think we are measuring something which is closely related, very closely related, to something which is exactly defined. What do we have to do in quantum mechanics to make exact sharp predictions in principle? Or exact sharp observations, forget about predictions. Even, what experiment would you have to do where if you did it enough, all the scatter in your plots would go away and all the points would line up on one point and give you one number. You have to do the experiment with an infinitely large apparatus, and you have to do it an infinite number of times. You need both things. Typically, in everyday life, the infinitely large apparatus is plenty infinite, because that amount, the infinitely large apparatus is so that these e to the negative n's that we're talking about can be ignored. In practice, that can easily be ignored already. E to the negative 10 to the 30 is plenty compared to the other problems that people have. Then you've got to do the experiment an infinite number n of times. Okay? But it's two limits. Repeating the experiment infinitely often, doing it with an infinitely large apparatus. The reason why we start having tension with quantum mechanics and gravity and cosmology is that some of those things become impossible. Doing the experiment with infinitely large apparatuses, doing certain kinds of experiments with infinitely large apparatuses becomes impossible because the apparatuses have mass and they eventually collapse the region into a black hole. And doing the experiment infinitely often becomes impossible in certain cosmological situations where you can't, where you just don't have time to do it. Okay? Or other things obstruct you from doing it. So, strictly speaking, just sharp observable quantities associated with the universe, because of quantum mechanics, only exist in these double limits, which apparently in practice we can't take exactly perfectly. It is perfectly fine for every practical purpose, but conceptually, that's the ultimate puzzle. All right, let me mention one other thing here. You see, this issue now is identical to, so let me just draw the states, but then the equivalence should be just dead manifest. The thing which bugs people a lot about interpreting quantum mechanics is this situation where we have the spin up, 1 over root 2 up, the apparatus flashes up, my brain thinks it's up, plus 1 over root 2 down, it's flashing down, my brain thinks it's down. Okay? So this is what happens if a good experiment happens and I'm paying attention. Okay? If I'm looking at the apparatus properly. By the way, if I'm doing something else, then my state will be I don't care or something else, right? Then, I'm assuming that I'm paying attention to the experiment. This is a state that we're talking about. Okay? So what bugs people is, why is it after we do the experiment that we feel a unique outcome? We see that it was just up. when this is the wave function of the universe, this entangled way, it's both up and down, different branches, all sorts of mysticism and fog begins immediately. Okay? But just ask the question in the same straightforward way. It's exactly the same as is it a line question. In order to address the question, are we sure of the outcome of the experiment, we need to invent an operator, call the are you sure operator. Okay? There must be such an operator in the Hilbert space. I don't need to tell you about the theory of human consciousness or anything to come up with, to tell you the salient features of that operator. That operator should have the feature that it acts on any one of these states to give me one. Right? And therefore, it acts on any linear combination of them to give me one. So that's why I'm sure of the outcome. We could once again ask, am I sure it's up? Am I sure it's up operator? This is definitely not an eigenstate of the am I sure it's up operator. And that's good because I'm not sure it's up. It could be down. Okay? But I am sure either way that it's one or the other. Right? And I think the analogy with the is it a line question should just be perfectly clear from this way of setting it up. Yeah, you had a question.
What does it mean to have a linear combination of those states?
Oh, so, sorry, I didn't say it.
Well,
this is how it happened, right? Imagine I'm the experimentalist, God forbid. I built the apparatus. I don't like rag. I love experimentalists. Some experimentalists are some of my best friends. I don't know if Scott gotten into me. So I built an apparatus, right? So the apparatus is built to have the property that if I send in spin up, the apparatus, well, if I send in up and the apparatus is in its ground state, and I'm in my ground state, okay? Whatever my ground state is, okay? Before the experiment. The apparatus I designed to do the following. So that the interaction Hamiltonian between the apparatus and the system is designed to make this flash up. And I did that, I designed it that way because there's also an interaction between me and the apparatus. Right? When that green light goes on saying it's up, then it fires something in my brain so that I know it's up. Right? So there's also an interaction between this and this that makes me think I think up. Right? Some electrons in my neurons in my brain are firing in this way or that way, whatever it takes for me to mean to think it's up. So that's the purpose of me as the experimentalist designing the apparatus to measure the spin. Okay, we have a chain of interactions between us to allow this to happen. So therefore, if I send in 1/√2 up plus down, I will get that state. Okay? Now what I'm saying is what bugs people is just what we're talking about. What bugs people is that it somehow feels like if neither thing has happened, both are going on, there's something mysterious and strange, but it's no more mysterious and strange than the is it a line question, right? This is the state of the whole universe, but if you ask a question about are you sure of the outcome of the experiment, the answer is yes, you're sure. If you ask are you sure it's spin up, the answer is no, you're not sure. But if you ask, are you sure of an outcome, the answer is yes, you're sure. And it's a non-trivial statement, because if I wasn't paying attention and it was set up but I thought down, then it would also not be sure. And that's good, because I'd be confused, right? So only it acts on the things when I'm actually sure what happened, and in those situations, I'm sure of the outcome of the experiment. So as I said, if you have lectures on the foundations and interpretation of quantum mechanics, which you may well have, I'm sure people will talk about this. I'm sure these people know this. Something about it still bugs them. I don't know what it is, but please ask them. And you know, maybe if one of you find out what it is, maybe you can send me an email. You know, that would be great. I haven't succeeded in figuring out what it is for 15 years, but there are some. I just don't know what it is. Okay. Okay, any more questions about that stuff? I really encourage you to think about these, these things. There are some, a bit of a mischaracterization of what the attitude of many of theoretical physicists is to these questions. Sometimes it sort of characterizes a shut up and calculate approach. But actually, shut up and calculate is actually a somewhat more refined, is a somewhat more refined philosophy than it sounds. The people who shut up and calculate tend to be the people who have thought about these questions a lot more and a lot more deeply than the people who don't. And it's because when you actually calculate, you see what the juice is. You see what the meat is to the underlying issues at hand. You see, we actually learned something thinking about it, right? So you should think about any physical question that occurs to you. If it turns into a physics problem, you should think about it. Measurement is a physics problem. So saying shut up and just ignore it, and no, definitely don't ignore it. You know, it's crazy. It's crazy to think that measurement is something different than everything else, and the wave function collapses, you start all over again. Definitely not. It's very worthwhile thinking about it. Okay, but that's because you could really isolate a nice, sharp question. You could say, oh yeah, I'm measuring something. What about a fly? What about a flea? What about 30 atoms wandering by, right? There's an actual puzzle to think about. You start thinking about it, there's a nice, very beautiful physical story associated with it. Okay? So shut up and calculate doesn't mean don't think. It means really think very deeply. But try to see immediately what actual observable issue your question connects to, what computation it might affect, how you would go about trying to, how it would actually affect something. It's not that people don't care about these sort of deep philosophical questions about quantum mechanics. They really do. But they care about it precisely to the extent where you push on it and there's clearly a physics question at stake. There's some experimental thing you could imagine changing things. You could imagine, can you weaken the interaction with the environment? Can you delay decoherence? You know, all sorts of physical questions start coming up. But when you start going round and round and round in circles that feel like they're completely linguistic, then there's something wrong. And it's very likely that there isn't something deep there. And instead, it's the frailty of human language coming in. The equations are very helpful. Equations are very helpful as we go further and further into less and less familiar territory. They're helpful not to excuse ourselves from not thinking, but to actually help us. They're a lifeline from making sure that we're not fooling ourselves and seeing that there's actually something at stake. So that's what's really meant by the shut up and calculate approach. Feynman, who said this, shut up and calculate, understood these things amazingly well. Okay, and he understood these things amazingly well before they were sort of as widely understood as they were now. There isn't this big distinction between people who calculate things and people who think. It's in fact people who calculate things well tend to think the most. And they know where all the weak points are, but it just seems it certainly seems to me that all the essential issues with quantum mechanics are fine, except for what I told you about, having to do with cosmology ultimately. Very good. So let's now move on to talking about the synthesis of quantum mechanics and relativity. Okay. So we're going to do quantum field theory in 45 minutes. Actually, we're probably not going to do it in 45 minutes, but okay. So let's first talk about the most important zeroth order thing. Particles. So the first thing to get straight is that fundamentally, everything we're talking about is about the interaction of particles. There's no such thing as sometimes there's waves, sometimes there's particles. There's wave-particle duality. This is all an incredibly old-fashioned way of talking. Everything in the world is particles. In a very specific sense, we'll see. Everything is particles, but they're quantum mechanical particles, not classical particles. And sometimes macroscopic collections of quantum mechanical particles, when they're bosons, macroscopic collections of quantum mechanical particles have a nice interpretation in terms of classical waves. So quantum particles can turn into classical waves when the particles are bosons, and there are lots and lots of them. Macroscopic collections of fermions look like particles, classical particles. So there's classical waves, classical particles. Underlying is quantum particles. The field is a secondary notion, as we're just about to see. Fields are a convenient way of talking about the interaction of particles. But to see that, I want to go back and actually tell you more abstractly what a particle is, what we think of, what particles are. And just to say the statement, what we would like to think of as single particle states. Single particle states are irreducible representations of the Poincaré group. Okay? Remember, I told you that I told you that we have these symmetries, and it's a good idea to talk about what those symmetries can act on. Okay? If you have symmetries, we should talk about what they can act on. And the things they act on can be broken down into these irreducible representations, these irreducible things that they act on. Okay? So particles are the things that the Lorentz group, the full Poincaré group, actually acts on. But the theory is quantum mechanical. So when we say acts on, I mean that if I hand you some Lorentz transformation and a translation, so let's say there's translations and Lorentz transformations. If I hand you some translation and Lorentz transformation, you have to come up with some unitary operator that acts on the Hilbert space of the theory and gives you an action of that Poincaré transformation. Okay? So associated with every Poincaré transformation, every translation and Lorentz transformation, there should be some unitary matrix, some unitary operator, that acts on the Hilbert space of the theory. Okay? And the set of states that these unitary transformations act on in an irreducible way, the simplest things they act on in an irreducible way are what we call particle states. Okay? So that's abstractly what particles are. Now, let me just say this a little bit intuitively, and then we'll start seeing it, we'll start actually doing it. But intuitively, why does it have to do with the symmetries? That sounds a little funny, right? Why do particles have something to do with the symmetries? Well, let's take it one step at a time. So, what's special about having a particle move with a constant velocity in this direction? Okay, a momentum eigenstate, right? A momentum eigenstate. What's special about momentum eigenstates is that momentum eigenstates behave nicely under translations, right? A particle that's just sitting exactly at the, right. A particle which is in an x eigenstate. In an x eigenstate, under translations, the state changes to a different state. But a p eigenstate, under translations, it just picks up an overall phase, right? E to the I px goes to e to the I pa times e to the I px, if you translate x by a. That's why we use momentum eigenstates all the time. That's why Fourier transformations are useful. It's because the momentum eigenstates are the irreducible representations of translations, if you want to say it in a fancy way. Okay? So translations act nicely on momentum eigenstates. They act on momentum eigenstates like a phase. Okay? So momentum eigenstates are eigenstates of translations. So in a world that's translation invariant, it's therefore useful to talk about momentum eigenstates. So now we're imagining particles moving along with some fixed momentum, all right? Now, so let's say we have an electron moving this way with some momentum. When the electron is moving that way, we keep calling it the electron. We say, oh, it's an electron moving that way, or an electron moving that way, or an electron moving that way. We use the same word for it, electron, over and over again. Why? They're not the same. It's moving that way. It's moving that way. They're not the same state. Why do we use the same word for it? That's because of rotational invariance. Okay? Because because of rotational invariance, one electron does moving that way and doing that way are very closely related to each other. Okay, you just do a rotation to move from one to the other. Let's do a sort of counterexample to make this clearer. Let's say there was a gigantic magnetic field in the z direction. Huge magnetic field in the z direction. So this badly breaks full rotational invariance, right? I only have rotational invariance in the plane. So let's say the magnetic field, huge magnetic field in the room pointing in the z direction, all right? And so there's still rotational invariance in the plane, but there isn't full rotational invariance. Now let's talk about what we would colloquially refer to as electrons. Electrons moving this way look radically different than electrons moving that way. Electrons moving that way just sail along, no problem. Electrons moving this way zip around in little circles, right? Because of the big magnetic field. We could continue to insist on calling them electrons, but now it starts becoming a little more useless notion. It's actually pretty convenient to think about two different kinds of objects, the z-moving electrons and the plane-moving electrons. Okay? They really behave differently. And now, in these simple cases, we still find it convenient to use the notion of electron and just say, ah, it's different when it goes this way versus that way. But as you go further and further and further in physics, let's say you're talking about high-temperature superconductors. Okay? In high-temperature superconductors, there are electrons moving along in this, trapped in this, on these two-dimensional sheets in these materials. And now that electron, what it does on those two-dimensional planes inside the high-temperature superconductor, you could keep calling it an electron if you like, but it's now worse than a useless notion. Okay? Because now that thing inside there, in that material, stuck on this two-dimensional sheet, is so radically different than an electron out here that you're now just torturing yourself calling it that. And it's useful to start coming up with different things. What are the natural excitations that move in these two-dimensional regions? And even though fundamentally it's the underlying electron, blah, 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 what ends up being a useful way of talking about things is to just talk about the natural excitations associated with the system that you're talking about. So in condensed matter, people call these quasi-particles, and they get further and further and further removed from the standard electron on the outside. Okay? So this is just stressing something important, that you know, we come up with these notions and these names and these ideas because they're useful, and we shouldn't forget. If they start becoming more of a hindrance than a help, then you come up with other ways of thinking about it. Even though it's in principle true that the electrons in the fractional quantum Hall effect are the same as the electrons in the everyday world, there's a nicer, more natural way of thinking about what they are, which is intrinsically two-dimensional. Okay. Anyway. But we're talking about things in more or less in vacuum, so rotational invariance is a good symmetry. Everything is fine. And that's why we give it the same name. We say it's the electron this way, the electron moving that way, but we call them all the electron. Okay? Okay. So what we'd like to do now is extend this notion fully relativistically. So actually, before we do something relativistic, before we do something relativistic, how would we label what should particles mean just in a particles mean in a non-relativistic world where we have translations and rotations, let's say. Okay? Well, in order to make the action of translations nice, we use momentum eigenstates. Okay? And in order to make the actions of rotations nice, how do rotations act? Well, we know what the irreducible representations of rotations are. They're just spin. Right? Spin a half, spin one, spin two, and so on. That just tells you what are the labels that you can possibly have on any states on which translations and rotations act nicely. The labels those states have are a momentum and a spin. Okay? So that's it. Those are the sorts of states on which rotations act nicely. Rotations and translations act nicely. Now, we want to generalize that to relativity. Okay? Now we have translations, rotations, boosts, we have the whole Lorentz group, and we want to figure out what are the possible labels that I can associate to states on which the translations and Lorentz transformations act nicely. Is the strategy clear here? We're just trying to figure out what can these symmetries act on, possibly, right? Now, just to cut to the chase, the answer is going to end up being the following. When the particle is massive, it's the same thing that we're just used to. That kind of makes sense, right? It's always momentum. It's always going to be energy and momentum now, relativistically. There's translations, space and time translations. So it's labeled by some p mu, some energy and momentum. But when the particle is massive, it's also labeled by spin, okay, by what its spin is. We'll see, the interesting thing we'll see is that when the particle is massless, it isn't labeled by spin. It's labeled by helicity. Massless particles have a different number of degrees of freedom than massive particles do. This is a very, very, very basic but very striking feature of relativistic quantum mechanics. And it's because I can't boost to a frame where the particle is at rest. Okay? If I could boost to a frame where it was at rest, then any spin that it had, I could rotate into any other frame. Okay? But if it's massless, I can't do that. So all I can talk about is a component of its spin along the direction of motion, which is the helicity. It's very striking. There's a discontinuous difference between massless spin 1 particles, for example, and massive spin 1 particles. Massless spin 1 particles have 2 degrees of freedom. Massive spin 1 particles have 3 degrees of freedom. That's a very significant difference. Perhaps we'll have more to say about that later. But actually, all of these peculiar features of the massless particles are also what end up incredibly constraining what their interactions can look like and forcing these ideas of gauge redundancy, general covariance. All these things are actually just convenient crutches to help us deal with this peculiar feature of massless particles, that they only have helicity. Okay. So let me sketch what the, now how this argument works a little more formally. This whole discussion goes back to Wigner. But it's kind of foundational. This is what particles are. So you might as well see once properly what they are. So let's first deal with the translations. So the translations are easy. That means we're going to label the particles by momenta, by four momenta. Okay? So if I want to label some state on which translations and Lorentz transformations act nicely, let's first do the translations. So I'll label them with some momentum p mu. And whatever other labels they have, whatever they are, let's just give them a global name. We don't know what they are yet. Let's just call them all, the rest of them, sigma. Okay. So on this guy, translations, if I translate, there's a unitary operator associated with translating by an amount a mu. Okay. Translating x mu goes to x mu plus a mu. Okay. So if that's what I mean by a translation, then this unitary operator acts on this to give me e to the I p dot a p mu sigma. Okay. So I made sure the translations are acting as simply as possible. Momentum eigenstates are eigenstates of translations. Okay. So we did that quickly. Now I have to talk about how Lorentz transformations act. Okay? And now things get more interesting. So in other words, if someone hands me some Lorentz transformation lambda mu nu, okay? Yes? No, p mu a mu. Yeah, it's a four-vector product. Okay? Everything is Lorentz invariant here. So if someone hands me a Lorentz transformation lambda mu nu, I need to come up with some unitary operator u associated with lambda that acts it on the states, right? So I need to figure out what is u of lambda acting on p and sigma. That's what I need to figure out. Okay? What can the action possibly be? Now, there's a most naive possible answer here. What's the most naive possible answer? Yeah. Well, no, not quite, because it has the Lorentz transform of the momentum. Right? Because under Lorentz transformations, P would go to lambda P. So I'm boosting the momentum. So it can't be, this is not going to be the same state back. It should be a state of a different momentum. But then the most naive thing would be, oh, well, I guess I just changed the momentum. Okay? That's the most naive answer. This indeed would give you some action of Lorentz transformations on these states, but is not the most general one. It is not the most general one. The most general one, whatever this state is, you see, whatever this state is, we know that the value of its momentum is lambda p. We know that much, right? However, something slightly more general could happen. The slightly more general thing that could happen is that if I have a bunch of these indices sigma, okay, the more general thing that could happen is that I could get a sum over sigma prime of some matrix D sigma sigma prime, which is also a function of lambda in the end, times lambda p and sigma prime. Okay? That's the most general thing that could happen. And this matrix D sigma sigma prime will of course be a unitary matrix in this sigma space, in the space of whatever these sigma indices are. See, what we're trying to do here is ask the abstract question, what's the most general action of the unitary action of the Poincaré group on states? Since we decided to have this label to begin with, the most general possible action would also involve a unitary transformation on those labels. Okay? So we need to figure out what those D's can possibly be. Now, just in order for it not to sound incredibly abstract, if this particle had a spin, if this was all non-relativistic, if we weren't caring so much about relativity for a second, that D would be nothing other than some rotation, right? It would be the rotation that acts on the spin of the particle. Okay? So sigma would be the spin, would be the indices that go with the spin of the particle, and D would be the rotation in that representation. If it's a spin 5 particle, D would be the 5x5 matrix that implements three-dimensional rotations. Okay? All right? But we don't know that yet. So we want to figure out what that D can possibly be. All right. So in order to do this, what Wigner did in order to figure out what these D's are, he had a good idea, which was the following. He said, look, let's pick some reference momentum K mu. Okay? So let's say I have a massive particle. I'm going to pick some reference momentum K mu. Let's say K mu is M000. The particle's at rest. Okay? The frame where the particle's at rest. Just we'll pick some reference momentum. Then any other momentum, which has p squared equals m squared, any other momentum can be written in terms of some Lorentz transformation on k. Right? So let's first just talk about a canonical way of labeling all the states. The problem, you see, the entire problem here is how do we relate these sigma indices from one value of the momentum to another value of the momentum? So in order to understand that, let's just be very careful and start off defining for this reference momentum the state K sigma. Then let's say that any other momentum, which has the same P squared, okay, any other momentum I'm going to write as L that depends on P acting, so this is a Lorentz transformation, L mu nu depending on P acting on K nu. Okay? Even the L's are my choice. Okay? Sometimes there's more than one Lorentz transformation in general you can do to map one particle to another. For example, I can take a particle at rest, I can boost it so it's moving, Now I can do any rotation I like around this axis of motion. It's not going to change the momentum that I got, right? So there isn't a unique L. There isn't a unique way of mapping one momentum to another momentum. Just pick one. Pick any one that you like. Okay? These L's are your choice. There are canonical, ahead of time chosen way of writing any momentum in terms of a Lorentz transformation on K. Is it clear what I mean by L of P? Okay, so you choose whatever you like. Now, we can now define what I mean by P and sigma with the same index sigma here. Very same one. This is just a definition. I will define this to be U associated with that Lorentz transformation, L of P, acting on K and sigma. So I'm looking for what these unitary transformations are, but they're out there. I'm just trying to figure out how to characterize them. But whatever they are, let me simply define. I will simply define what the states P sigma are by doing this unitary transformation associated with that canonical Lorentz transformation on K and sigma. This is definition. I stress this is a definition. Okay? So good. Now I have now I've defined every state in I have a definition for every state in the theory. For every momentum, I know what I mean by all of the states. Okay? Yes. Sorry? That's simply how we define what the state is. Okay? I define the state P sigma to be U on K and sigma. That's just a definition of what the state is. You see, I don't have another way. I abstractly don't have any way of relating the sigmas, the different values of P, to each other. So let me just give one. I give this canonical one. So this is just saying, if you define, I mean, it's really saying something. It's saying something very basic. If you say that the states of the particle at rest are spin up and spin down, and there are some unitary transformation for a fixed L that you like, I'm just going to define the state of spin up when it's moving to be the boost of the state that you gave. That's just a definition. Okay? That's just a very nice canonical definition. If you like, any other definition you might choose would involve some extra unitary transformation on the sigmas, which you can put in if you like. It won't change our discussion. Okay? But let's just leave it like this because it's the simplest possible thing, and it's canonical. Okay. Okay. All right. So now I've defined all the states. Now we can go back to our question. What is U for any old lambda acting on P and sigma? Okay. Well, this is U of lambda acting on U of L of P on K and sigma. Now, what we're tempted to do is we know that this ultimate momentum is lambda P, right? The ultimate momentum of this state is lambda P. So you'd be tempted to write this as U of L of lambda P acting on K, right? The ultimate momentum has momentum lambda P. So it's expressed in terms of K as L of lambda P on K. Okay? So let's try to write it that way manifestly. So let's write this just by multiplying and by this and its inverse. So let's put U of L of lambda P, U of L of lambda P inverse, U of lambda, U of L of P on K and sigma. Looks like a bit of a bit of a funny operation. But of course, these U's, the point is that their group. So U of G1, G2 is the U of the product. Okay? So I can write this as U of L of lambda P acting on U of the following seeming mess, L inverse of lambda P, lambda L of P, acting on K and sigma. Now, this funny combination, let's call it W for Wigner. Okay? So W depends on a lot of things. It depends on lambda. Well, it depends on lambda. It depends on P. Okay? But what does this Lorentz transformation W due to K? W takes K to L of P times K, which is P, to lambda P, and then back to K. There's no subscript. This is lambda multiplied by P.
Oh.
Okay. So it's the Lorentz transformation lambda acting on P.
Okay.
Sorry, it's not a subscript. It's lambda P. Okay, so W does something interesting. W, so if I wrote explicitly W mu nu of lambda and P acting on K nu is equal to K mu. And so that means that U of W acting on K and sigma must equal some sum over sigma prime in general, a d sigma prime that depends on what this W is, but now acting on the same K again, K and sigma prime. Didn't change K. So remember, we were after what these matrices D look like in general. We've simplified the problem now. We have to figure out what these matrices D look like for these special Lorentz transformations W that leave the K vector invariant. Okay? So since this is the case, in fact, we can write the answer to our ultimate question, U of lambda on P and sigma is then equal to the sum over sigma prime, d sigma prime, that depends on this W, which in turn depended on lambda and P, on lambda P and sigma prime. Right? Because since this is the case, now I had on the outside a U of L of lambda P acting on all of this, the U of L of lambda P now takes this, it hits the K, it changes it to lambda P, and it doesn't touch sigma prime. That was the whole point, right? Okay, so this is a really nice and interesting equation. It's a nice and interesting equation because it tells us something about what acts on these sigmas alone. The thing that acts on these sigmas alone are not general Lorentz transformations. But these matrices D have to furnish the representation of a different group. What are all these W's? The set of these W's aren't all Lorentz transformations. There are Lorentz transformations that leave the K vector invariant. Okay? So this is a different interesting group. It's called the little group. And it's the Lorentz transformations W that leave K invariant. Okay? And so what we found is that these indices sigma prime, whatever they are, have to furnish a representation of the little group. Okay? This is now a simpler problem. The indices sigma prime furnish a representation of the little group. Okay, beautiful. So let's do a quick example just in our heads. Let's say we have massive particles. So p squared is equal to m squared, k squared is equal to m squared. They're all positive. So a nice choice for k would be m 0, 0, 0, right? That's a nice canonical k, just the particle at rest. So what is the little group for this massive particle? Right. What are all the Lorentz transformations that leave that vector m 0, 0, 0 invariant are just rotations. And so we find that these indices have to furnish a representation of the rotation group. Very good. That's what we talked about yesterday. You know, if you have a spin 5 particle, or spin 2 particle, then it's a 5 by 5 matrix. 5 by 5 matrices that represent three-dimensional rotations. Okay? But it tells you what they all are. I mean, maybe they're spin 17 particles, whatever. The labels that these particles can have, the labels that massive object, the states on which Lorentz transformations and translations act nicely are labeled by momenta and some other quantities, and we discovered when those momenta satisfy p squared is positive, those other quantities are spin. Okay? So massive particles are labeled by spin. And as part of their label, you don't need to think about a deeper origin, where does spin a half particles come from, why are there this? It's exactly the other way around. The particles are just the representations. Okay? That's just it's just one of the labels that massive particles carry. Okay? And in fact, this exhausts the labels that they can carry. Well, they can carry other labels as well, but then the Lorentz transformations will simply not act on them. Okay? So this is the irreducible representation of translations and Lorentz transformations acting on massive particles. Okay? So now let's do the more interesting example. Yes?
You can't actually label particles with the moment, but only its invariant plane.
No, you can label it with its momentum. It is labeled with its momentum. Yeah. And that's right. So that's exactly what we're doing. So we figured out how to represent the action of the symmetry of that we know it has in the nicest possible way. That's what particles are. Particles, what we colloquially call particles, correspond to states in the Hilbert space on which the action of the symmetries are as nice as humanly possible. Okay? Is that clear? And we learned something. We learned that when the particles are massive, they're labeled by their mass, their spin, and perhaps other labels, their names, you know, like or other things on which Lorentz transformations do not act. Lorentz and Poincaré transformations do not act. Okay. All right. So let's move on to the case where the particle is massless. So this is a little more exciting. So what is the little group in this case? Now it's a little harder to visualize. Right? If you have a particle, well, we can visualize one of the generators. Let's say a particle is moving in the z-axis. Okay, then there's one completely obvious Lorentz transformation that leaves it invariant. Just the rotation along the direction it's moving. Right? So if it's moving in the z-direction, we do a rotation around the z-axis. That clearly leaves the momentum invariant. But there are two other generators that leave it invariant. There should be three generators that leave it invariant. Why? Well, there are three that left massive particles invariant, right? Just the three rotation. And it can't change discontinuously. Okay? So the number of generators can't change discontinuously. However, as we'll see, the algebra is significantly different. Okay? It's actually a literal analog of the relationship between Galilean relativity and special relativity. You know, Newtonian mechanics has Galilean invariance. Galilean invariance is just as much relativity as special relativity is. The number of symmetry generators associated with Galilean transformations is exactly the same as the symmetry generators associated with Lorentz transformations. It's not less powerful. Okay? There are boosts and rotations and translations also in Galilean relativity. Just the boosts are x goes to x minus vt. Right? So the number of symmetry generators is identical. However, the Galilean group is a sort of deformation of the Lorentz group. It's a deformation of the limit as you send c to infinity. As you send c to infinity, the algebra changes, and it becomes a little more boring. Okay? Certain quantities that are non-zero in the Lorentz case go to zero as you send c to infinity. That's another nice exercise that you can do. If you worked out some of the commutation relations for the Lorentz group yesterday, you can see what happens as you send c to infinity. It's called the contraction. Is that what it's called? I forget what it's called. Maybe it's called the contraction. Anyway, it has a name for what happens when you take one group and you send some parameter to infinity and it gets deformed to another one. Okay? Let's actually just stop for a second and imagine what that might be in this case. We'll see that it is. But when the particle is massive, it's like rotations, right? So it's like rotations which are taking a sphere and rotating it in any way, right? What sort of contraction might you even imagine that such a symmetry has? If you take that sphere and you make it infinitely big, then all of the translations, all of the rotations on the sphere, let's say you're in the neighborhood of the North Pole, right? Then what's in the underlying case when it was a sphere are full rotations, becomes just the rotation around the z-axis and translations in the plane. Because it looks flat. Okay? It looks like a two-dimensional Euclidean space. And so the symmetries become rotations around the z-axis and just translations in x and y. But you see, translations in x and y commute with each other. Rotations, jx and jy, don't commute with each other. But translations in x and y commute with each other. So it's the same kind of thing. We're taking a limit of the rotations with a parameter. The parameter goes to infinity, corresponds to the mass going to zero, and the rotation group turns into this just the set of symmetries of the Euclidean plane, okay, which isn't non-abelian anymore. It doesn't have the commutators are more boring. Anyway, that's just a picture to hold on to. But let's just see very concretely what's going on. So if we want to find these Lorentz transformations, once again, let's find the generators. So if I write W as delta mu nu plus some little omega mu nu, just like we did yesterday, then what we're after is an omega mu nu which annihilates K. So omega on K is equal to zero, because we want W to leave K invariant. Okay? So if I'm writing W mu nu equals delta mu nu plus epsilon omega mu nu, but I want W mu nu k to equal k, that tells me that omega mu nu on k nu should equal zero. Okay, so let's just do it dead explicitly. Remember from last time, we figured out what the most general omega mu nu matrix can look like. Okay? So if this is 0, 1, 2, 3, 0, 1, 2, 3, it was something that looked like zeros here. Then it looked like A, B, C, plus A, plus B, plus C, the same on this side. And then some capital A, capital B, capital C, negative A, negative B, negative C, something like that. Right? That's what we decided last time, the most general omega mu nu of Lorentz transformations looked like. But now we're trying to look for special ones that are going to annihilate K. And let's say that K is pointing, so that's omega mu nu. Let's say that K is equal to 1, 1, 0, 0. So it's a particle moving in that direction. in the one direction, let's say. All right? Now I want to find an omega mu nu that annihilates K. So I have to take this thing, multiply it by 1, 0, 0, and get 0. So let's multiply it. So what is this? Well, the top entry is A. The next entry is A. The next entry is B minus A. The last entry is C minus B. Okay? So I have to have that this is equal to 0. So that tells me what this omega mu nu can look like. So now let's write the most general omega mu nu that we can have. The most general omega mu nu is then equal to 0, 0, 0. Then I have, I might as well call it AA, because little b was equal to capital A. Little c was equal to capital B, so I might as well call it BB, AB, negative A, negative B, 0, C, negative C, 0. Okay, that's the most general omega mu nu that I can have, which annihilates K for massless particles, because we're doing massless particles there. K is 1, 1, 0, 0. For massive particles, we did it already. That's just what you said, the rotations. Okay, so we worked out. So for massive particles, the omega would just be this bottom. It would force A, B, and C to equal 0, and then we just have all these bottom guys. So those are the rotations. For massless particles, we have these guys. So you see, once again, there's three generators, right? Because A, B, and C can be completely arbitrary. Let's see. I mean, some of them have obvious interpretations. Who is C? Who is this generator here? That's just the rotations around the one axis. Okay? It's rotation on the 2, 3 plane. So that obviously leaves this invariant. But we're learning something that if I do a boost in the y direction, followed by a rotation, I can bring it back. So the particle's moving in the x axis, right? I do a boost in the y direction, so it's now moving a little that way. But now I bring it back to the original vector by doing a rotation to bring it back. Okay? So that's the Lorentz transformation that leaves it invariant. It's a boost followed by a rotation back. The one boost that's not allowed is a boost just in the direction of motion. That obviously doesn't leave it invariant, right? It boosts it, changes it. That's why I set A to 0. Okay? But some combination of the other boosts and rotations can leave this light-like vector invariant. Okay? So beforehand we would have generators. So let's call this generator J23. Which is rotations in the 2, 3 plane. So let's just call it J. So J is the one that's 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, negative 1, 0. And let's call the other two T2 and T3. 2 and 3 because they're labeled like this. We could call this J23. This is the rotation on the 2, 3 plane. The particle is moving in the x-axis. So it's rotation of the... Now, exercise is to work out the commutation relations for these j's and the t's. Okay? Beforehand, I had the same thing. Beforehand, I had J23, and I had just these guys without them, right? The only difference between the generators before and after is that now I have these components. Before, it was just like that. Now I have them too. For massive particles, these columns would have been 0. For massless particles, they're not 0. Okay? So, yeah.
Sorry, what are the T's?
Oh, so T2 would be this guy. 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, minus 1, 0, 0, 0. Oh, shit. 1. 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay? So T2 is just the generator that's proportional to A here. OK? Okay? And T3 is a generator that's proportional to B. Okay? So beforehand, we would have called them J23, J13, and J12. That's when they would just correspond to these guys with zeros in those entries, right? Now I'm choosing to call them T2 and T3 rather than what I would have called them before, which is T12 and T13. Okay? Let me just call them T2 and T3. But clearly, there's some commutation relations they have. In fact, this is where this notion of the contraction comes from. You might even imagine, just for the fun of it, writing some coefficient there, just putting a coefficient t, and just seeing what happens to the commutation relations when t equals 0 and t equals 1. Just see what happens. Or write it as 1 minus t. See what happens when t equals 0 and t equals 1. So you might just interpolate between generators that look like one sort and another. Okay? But what you'll find, is that the commutation relations are that T2 and T3 commute, and that T2 and J23 is equal to T3, and T3 and J23 is equal to negative T2. These are the commutation relations. So these are exactly what you'd expect, as I said. It's exactly what you expect for the group of symmetries of translations and rotations on a two-dimensional plane. Okay? The two translations in the two and three directions commute with each other. Right? And the commutator of a translation in the x direction with the rotation in z is a translation in y. You're very familiar with that from quantum mechanics, right? Just standard quantum mechanics. And the other way around. Okay? So this could be called E2, Euclidean, the group of two-dimensional translations and rotations in Euclidean space. Okay, we're almost done. We're almost done. Yeah?
The T2 and T3 translations, they are boosts and composite.
That's right. But let's call them quote translations, because it ends up looking like translations in this two-dimensional plane. Okay? These commutation relations are exactly the commutation relations that you would describe to the T's being the translations in a two-dimensional plane. If you put in that little t parameter, as I told you, you do that little exercise and see how you interpolate from one algebra to the other, you'll exactly see that it has the interpretation of blowing up the size of a sphere and sending it to infinity around the North Pole. So around the North Pole, the space locally flattens out, and the what used to be the full rotations in all their non-abelian glory, the other rotations turn into translations, and it contracts to this group. But that's just to help you see how this is happening more and more smoothly. But this is the result. Okay, so now what we're supposed to do, according to Wigner, is figure out how this group acts on particles. Sure, it's just fine representations of this little algebra. This is very easy. T2 and T3 commute with each other. So it's very convenient to label any state I might talk about with eigenvalues of T2 and T3. Okay? So let's do it. Here's an eigenstate. Let's call it T2 and T3. Here's a typical state that I could have. Okay? However, there's a small problem. If this is a state, then if I do any rotation on it, if I now act on it with e to the I theta, if I act on it with e to the I theta j, 2, 3, then I'm going to get the rotated state, right? I'm going to get some other state where it's T2 prime, T3 prime, just rotated. So this is a two-dimensional plane now. This is in T2, T3 space. So if I have this value, then I can get any other, I can rotate it and get a whole continuous infinity of different values of T2 and T3. In other words, if one state in this representation has a non-zero value of T2 and T3, then by the other, by rotations, I can get a continuous infinity of states. Right? That means that this, these extra labels that our particle is carrying, we have a massless particle. There's a massless particle, but we'd be saying that the massless particle has a continuous infinity. There's a continuous infinity different massless particles labeled by the values of T2 and T3. Okay. That's mathematically possible, but we haven't seen anything like it in nature. Okay. We haven't seen, there's a continuous infinity distinct to different kinds of particle species. Okay. So what's the only thing we can do? We have to simply declare that the only states we're going to allow are going to be the ones for which the eigenvalues of T2 and T3 are zero. Okay? So we then declare that we're only interested in states with T2 and T3 equal to zero. Okay? The states with T2 and T3 equal to zero, now, what do I label them by? Okay? So T2 and T3 are zero. And now the only thing that's left is their eigenvalue under J2,3. That's it. So I can label them simply by what the eigenvalue of J2,3 is. You see that acting on this state now, because T2 and T3 are zero, J has a, this state can be taken to be an eigenstate of, I can expand it in terms of eigenstates of J2,3 only. And so what they're labeled by, the irreducible representations are just labeled by whatever spin they have in the 2,3 direction. And that's it. So that's how we learn that massless particles are only labeled by their helicity. Okay. Actually, from this argument alone, you don't learn that the helicity has got to be a half integer value, a very small extension of the argument tells you the usual story that the helicities have got to be quantized. So let me summarize the story that we've learned. We've learned that for a massive particle, the states are labeled by P and some sigma, such that U of lambda acting on P and sigma is equal to the sum over sigma prime, really a rotation. This is just a good old-fashioned rotation, R sigma prime, associated with the W that you would build, associated with lambda and L and all that stuff. But it's a rotation acting on lambda P and sigma prime. That's for massive particles. For massless particles, we have P, and instead of sigma, the only possible helicity, it has one value. We can just call it H. It's just a number. Okay? H can be 1, a half, 1, 3 halves, minus 1, minus 3 halves, and so on. Okay? But it's just one number. There isn't a whole bunch of labels, a big matrix, nothing. Just one number. Let's call it H. So labeled by P in helicity H, and U of lambda on P and sigma is equal to just some stupid phase, e to the h theta. Now that theta depends on W. It's made out of the W that you get through the procedure that we talked about, but it's the action of, okay, that's the action of the little group acting on lambda P and H. Okay. Yes. Yes, thank you. Okay. Let me write this more clear. E to the I H times some theta of W acting on P and H. Okay. All right, so I think I'll leave it at that. We've now introduced the cast of characters. We see why particles are important. We see this crucial difference between massless and massive particles. Yes.
Sorry, when you rewrote it, should there be a lambda next to the p on the right hand side?
Sorry?
Should there be a lambda before the p on the right hand side?
You just want to do this? That's I'm running out of steam. Anything else wrong?
No, good.
Everything is right? Are you sure? The writing is also kind of crappy, actually. Here, massive. Because it's so massive. Massive. And then massive. So sad. But actually, that's too bad, because massive is more important than massive. But anyway. All right, very good. So that's the cast of characters. Tomorrow we'll start talking about what you have to do to be able to make these particles interact in a way that respects the most basic features of the world, like the fact that if someone does an experiment in Alpha Centauri, it doesn't affect what we're doing here. Okay? It turns out that in order to be able to make that happen, I'm really trying to describe the interaction between these particles. But in order to be able to make that happen, it's very convenient to, first of all, introduce a notion of creation and annihilation operators to help us just conveniently deal with the Hilbert space of these particles. There's no fields, we're not quantizing anything, it's just for our convenience, we're introducing a notion of creation and annihilation operators to help us keep track of all the different particle states that we can have. And then we find that in order to make sure that the interactions are local, that we have to group these creation and annihilation operators into fields. And that's the whole beginning of the assignment.
Okay, so I think I have a